declaring that it would be fitting to recall the Master's sermons on the open beach during his travels along the Sea of Tiberias. She introduced the idea of natural furnishings. The halls require constant care, but they return so much in the way of beauty and lovely scenery. The kind nurse fell silent for a moment, and then continued again. As I have already told you, most beautiful hall in our ministry is reserved for the governor's talks. Veneranda learned that he had always ancient Hellenic landscapes, and decorated it accordingly, shady bowers and seats composed of the interlaced branches of trees. Every 30 days the flowers change in species, and each month presents a new color scheme. The loveliest one is reserved for December, in honor of Jesus' birth, when our colony receives beautiful thoughts and earnest promises from our incarnate brothers, and we, in turn, send our hopes and service to the higher spheres in homage to the Master of Masters. Perhaps you already know that the governor visits us nearly every week, on Sundays. He stays for hours, conferring with the ministers of regeneration and talking to workers, offering valuable suggestions, examining our borderlines with the lower zone, receiving our visits and good wishes, and comforting convalescents. Sometimes, when he has time in the evenings, he stays to listen to music and to attend shows staged by the youth of our schools. Most visitors in the Astral City come to our ministry just to see that natural place which comfortably seats over 30,000 people. Listening to Narcisa, I experienced a pleasant sensation, half joy, half curiosity. Minister Veneranda's hall, she added, enthusiastically, is also magnificent. We give its upkeep special care and attention. All we can do in recognition of her great devotion is nothing compared to the outstanding service she has given us. This servant of the Lord has introduced numerous beneficial measures on behalf of the city's most unfortunate inhabitants. Her service record at the Astral City is considered by the government as one of the most praiseworthy. She has the greatest number of working hours in our colony, and is the oldest officer in the government and in the ministry. She has been in active service here for over 200 years. How venerable she must be! I exclaimed. You are right, she answered. She is one of the most highly evolved beings in our spirit colony. The 11 ministers who share the direction of the Ministry of Regeneration with her always seek her advice before making any important decision. Even the governor himself often consults her for her enlightened opinion. Only she and the governor have seen the Master Jesus in the resplendent spheres. Yet she never mentions that distinction of her spirit life. She avoids all reference to it. I can tell you of another significant incident. One day, 4 years ago, the Astral City prepared to entertain the Fraternities of Light who rule the Christian destinies of America. They were coming to pay their respects to Veneranda and to bestow the Service Merit Medal on her for having completed 1,000,000 consecutive hours of useful service with admirable devotion, perseverance and self-effacement. She is the first in the colony to be awarded with such an honor. When presented with the medal, she only wept in silence. Afterwards, she donated it to the town archives, and transferred the honor to the colony as a collective group, saying that she was unworthy of it. Despite the governor's protests, she requested that all the celebrations be cancelled. She never again alluded to this incident. What an extraordinary woman! I said, I wonder why she doesn't inhabit some higher sphere. Spiritually, she lives in planes far superior to ours, and only remains in the Astral City out of a great spirit of love and abnegation. I have heard that our sublime benefactress has been working for 1,000 years to help a group of loved ones still on Earth. Meanwhile, she waits for them with untiring patience. How might I come to know her? I asked earnestly. Pleased at my interest, she answered. Tomorrow evening, after the prayers, Minister Veneranda is coming to her hall to give some apprentices a lecture on thought. Chapter 33, Curious Observations. Just before midnight, with Narcisa's permission, I went to the gates of the chambers. The Samaritans were expected at any moment. It was necessary, therefore, to watch out for their arrival, so that the last-minute measures necessary might be taken in time. With emotion, I walked down the pathway, here and there, among the shady trees. I saw tree trunks suggesting the earth's hoary oak, and other leaves that bring to mind the acacia tree and the pine. In the open air I experienced a sensation of well-being such as I had never felt in the chambers, in spite of their ample windows. While advancing silently under the sheltering branches gently stirring in the breeze, I felt a profound peace fall upon me. I began to reminisce about events in my life after my first meeting with Minister Clarence. I wondered where the dream region was situated. Was it on Earth, or in this spirit colony? I wondered what had happened to Zilia and the children. Although I had received so many explanations about the most varied aspects of life, my earthly home was never mentioned. My own mother had advised silence and had only addressed this matter vaguely. It all implied that I should forget the problems of the flesh in order to achieve my inner renewal. Yet, probing deeply, I discovered that my longing for my family was still alive and strong. I yearned to see my beloved wife, to feel my children's caresses once again. Why should fate keep us apart, as if I were a castaway on some unknown shore? These questions perplexed me, but I was also comforted by the thought that I could not consider myself forsaken. If my earthly experiences might be classified as a wreck, it was all my own doing. Now that I had the opportunity to observe the vibrations of intense and constructive work at the Astral City, I could not help wondering how I, when on Earth, could have wasted so much time on trifles. True, I had loved my wife dearly, and had tenderly cherished our children, yet on examining my conduct as a husband and father, I realized that I had failed to build up anything solid and useful within the spirit of my family. I realized it only now, now that it was too late. Whoever advances along a road and neglects to sow the seed for a future harvest along the way, and fails to protect the fountain that quenches his thirst, cannot turn back expecting to find all he needs. These thoughts kept recurring in my mind with an irritating insistence. On leaving the physical sphere, I had been faced with the torture of incomprehension. I did not know what had happened to my wife and children, who were suddenly deprived of the accustomed domestic stability and confronted with the inevitable struggles of widowhood and orphanhood, but I saw no point in asking. A light breeze seemed to whisper lofty ideas, as if attempting to lift my mind to higher thoughts. Although tormented with these inner questions, I had to attend to the mission on which I had been sent. I approached the gate and scrutinized the distance beyond the tilling fields. All was moonlight and serenity, glorious heavens and peaceful beauty. I spent some minutes absorbed in awed prayer to the Creator of all things in contemplation of the lovely scenery before me. A few moments later I saw two enormous shapes. They puzzled me. They looked like men of some indefinable semi-luminous substance. Strange filaments hung from their arms and feet, and there was a thread connected to their heads. They gave me the impression of two ghosts, and I could not bear their sight. My hair standing on end, I ran back to the chambers. As I anxiously explained to Narcissa the cause of my terrors, she could hardly keep from laughing. "Well, now," she said, good-humoredly, "didn't you recognize those forms?" I was considerably abashed and did not know what to say. Narcissa smiled and explained. "I had the same experience, and was just as surprised as you. The explanation is simple, though. The forms you saw belong to our brothers from Earth. They are highly evolved spirits on some redeeming mission on the physical plane, who, as were the initiates of eternal wisdom, may temporarily abandon their fleshly bodies and travel freely through our spheres. The filaments and threads you observed are the characteristics which distinguish them from us. Therefore, you needn't fear. Incarnate men who succeed in reaching these regions are highly evolved spirits, though they may appear humble or obscure on Earth." In an encouraging voice she added, "Let's go out and see. It's 12:40. The Samaritans can't be long in coming." Satisfied with Narcissa's explanation, I followed her to the great gate. I could still see the two forms in the distance, calmly walking away from the astral city. Narcissa gazed at them, and remarked, "They are surrounded by blue light. They must be two advanced messengers from the physical plane on some mission we cannot know." We stood at the gate for some time, lost in the contemplation of the silent fields. Finally, my kind friend pointed out a dark spot traveling across the moonlit horizon. They had arrived. Looking intently in the direction Narcissa was pointing, I saw that the caravan was moving slowly towards us under the clear sky. All of a sudden I heard dogs barking in the far distance. "What's that?" I asked, startled.
"Why, dogs," said the nurse. "They are precious helpers in the obscure regions of the lower zone, which is inhabited not only by discarnate men, but also by real monsters. This, however, is not the proper time to describe them." Then, raising her voice, she called to the other servants in the distance, and sent one of them back to the chambers with the news of the Samaritan's arrival. I gazed curiously at the strange group approaching slowly. I counted 6 big carts or stagecoaches, each drawn by animals which, even from a distance, looked like mules and preceded by a lively pack of dogs. What caught my attention most were the bands of large birds flying close to the carts and making strange sounds. At this sight I turned to Narcissa and inquired, "Where is the Airbus? Couldn't they use it in the lower zones?" As Narcissa shook her head, I asked for an explanation. As usual, she was willing to oblige, and answered, "It's a problem of the density of matter. Water and air are a good example. An airplane which flies through the air cannot do the same in water. We can build machines such as submarines, for instance, which can carry us through denser matter, but in deference to the suffering inhabitants of the region, communities of higher planes prefer to use this simple means of transportation. Besides, we often can't do without animalcle aberration."
"Why is that?" I asked with astonishment. "Dogs simplify the work, and mules carry weight patiently and supply warmth when necessary. Those birds," she added, pointing to them in the air, "which we call traveling ibises, are the Samaritans' great allies. They eat hateful and wicked thought forms, helping to fight against the dark shapes of the lower zone." The caravan was growing nearer. Narcissa, gazing at me kindly, continued, "There is no time now for further details. You can find valuable lessons on animals not here, but in the Ministry of Elucidation, where the parks of instruction and experiments are located." Busily supervising the last-minute arrangements, the devoted nurse prepared to receive the new patients. Chapter 34, Newcomers from the Lower Zone. The packs of dogs, led by strong workers, halted as they approached us. Within minutes, we were all crossing the broad galleries leading into the chambers of rectification. Many attendants were hurrying about. Some of the weaker patients were being helped indoors. Not only Narcissa, Celestius and the others were working, the Samaritans were also doing their utmost, eager to aid the newcomers, some of whom waiting humbly for their turn while others complained loudly. As I also lent a hand, I noticed an old lady, trying with great difficulty to get down from the last carriage. When she saw me nearby she began to beg, "Please, son, for God's sake, help me to get down." I approached, interested. "Good heavens," she went on, forming the sign of the cross, "thanks to divine providence I have escaped purgatory. Oh, the wicked devils which tormented me there! What a hellish place! At last, heavenly angels have come to my rescue." I helped her down, again curious. For the first time I heard references to hell and purgatory from someone who seemed calm and reasonable to me. Prompted by my curiosity, I inquired, "So, have you come far?" Thus speaking, oblivious of Laura's advice, I affected great concern, as I had on earth. The poor woman perceived my interest and began telling her story. "Very far indeed. On earth,
My son, I was a lady of great virtues, charitable and pious, sincere in my beliefs. What can one do against Satan's wiles? On leaving the world, I found myself surrounded by monstrous beings which dragged me with them in a veritable whirlwind. At first I implored the protection of the celestial archangels, but the hellish spirits kept me prisoner. However, I never lost hope of being rescued at any moment, because I had left some money to have monthly masses celebrated for my eternal rest. Yielding to my pernicious habit of meddling into matters which were none of my business, I insisted. How interesting your observations are. Didn't you try to find out the reason you were kept so long in those regions? Absolutely not. She replied, crossing herself again. As I have already told you, I did my best to be good and pious while on earth. But you know that nobody is completely free from sin. As a rich woman, I might have led a peaceful life if it hadn't been for my slaves. They were always full of mischief and kept quarreling. Of course, punishment was often necessary. I had to be firm in giving my orders, always scrupulously carried out by my overseers. It wasn't rare for a Negro to die at the whipping post as a warning to others. Sometimes, to avoid trouble, I was obliged to sell slave mothers, separating them from their children. I felt the sting of my conscience on those occasions, but every month when Father Amancius visited the plantation I went to confession. After having received absolution in the confessional, I was free from all those venial sins and again in peace with God and the world in general. Shocked at these words, I began to reason with her. But sister, that kind of peace is false. The slaves are also our brothers, and to the Almighty Father, their children are just as good as their masters. She stamped her foot angrily in protest. God forbid. That could never be. Slaves are slaves, or the church would teach us otherwise. If there were slaves at the bishop's house, why shouldn't there be on our plantation? Who would work the land if not the Negroes? Believe me, it was an honor for them to live in my slave quarters. On my plantation, Negroes never came to the guests' courtyard except to carry out my orders. Father Amancius, our virtuous priest, once told me at confession that Africans are the worst creatures in the world, born exclusively to serve God in bondage. Do you imagine, then, that I would have scruples in dealing with them? You can be sure that slaves are wicked beings, the devil's own children. I sometimes admire my own patience in tolerating them on earth. Let me tell you, I passed over most unexpectedly from shock over the Princess Decree abolishing slavery 9. Just imagine, setting those scoundrels free. It all happened many years ago, but I can still remember it perfectly. I had been feeling poorly for a few days, when Father Amancius came from town with the disastrous news. The blow was terrible, and I began to get worse. How could we go on living with those ruffians at large? Of course, they would want us to pay them back by making us serve them. Wouldn't it be preferable to die, than to serve them? I remember I made my confession with difficulty. When it was over, Father Amancius gave me absolution and comforted me with encouraging words. It seems that all devils are African, spying on me all the time, and I have been obliged to suffer their presence until today. And when did you pass over? In May, 1888. I experienced a strange sense of amazement. The poor slave mistress, gazing with dim eyes at the horizon, remarked. It's possible that my nephews forgot to pay the masses, although I left it clearly specified in my will. I was about to answer her with new ideas on fraternity and faith, when Narciso approached and said kindly. 9. Slavery was abolished in Brazil on May 13, 1888 by a law signed by Princess Isabel, acting as a substitute for her father, Emperor Pedro II, who was traveling abroad. Translator's note. Listen, André, you seem to have forgotten that we are rendering assistance to patients and mentally deranged entities. What good will all this information be to you? Unbalanced people will talk incessantly, and whoever listens wastes spiritual attention, and may be no more balanced than they. She said those words in such sympathetic tones that I flushed with shame and was unable to offer an apology. Don't worry, my friend, she went on encouragingly, let's see to the perturbed brothers. Are you including me in their numbers? Asked the old lady, looking hurt. Narcisa, displaying her excellent expression of sympathy. Of course not, my dear, I didn't mean you. However, I think you must be tired after your long stay in the purgatorial zones. Yes, indeed I am. The newcomer agreed, you can't imagine my suffering and how I was tormented by those devils. The poor thing was about to begin the whole story again, but Narcisa cut her short. Do not dwell on evil. I know all about the bitter suffering you had to endure. Now, just relax here while I see to your needs. Turning to an attendant, she said. You, Zenobio, would you please go to the women's department and ask Nemesia to prepare a bed for our new sister awaiting treatment? Chapter 35, An Unexpected Meeting. We were busy putting away the patrolling equipment and seeing to the animals, when I heard a friendly voice beside me. Hello, André. Fancy meeting you here. What a pleasant surprise. I turned round and was surprised to recognize the Samaritan. He was a former acquaintance of ours on Earth. Yes, it was old Silveira, whom my father, the inflexible businessman, had reduced to utter ruin. I felt acutely embarrassed. I wanted to acknowledge his greeting, to respond to his friendly approach, but my memories made me speechless. In this new environment, where countenances faithfully reflect one's true feelings, pretending was out of the question. Finally, Silveira himself noticed my discomfort and came to my help, saying, I didn't know you had come here. I had no idea I'd meet you here in the Astral City. After this spontaneous kindness, I was able to shake his hand and murmur a few words of thanks. I wanted to offer an explanation for our past attitudes but couldn't find the right words. I truly wished to apologize for my father's actions, which had forced him into disastrous insolvency. Standing there, it all came back into my mind. It was like seeing a film. I could hear his wife's tearful voice, trying to explain her husband's plight. He had been ill for a long time and, to make matters worse, two of their children had also fallen sick. Their expenses had risen, and medical attention cost so much money. I remember how the poor thing wept, begging for a respite. She spoke humbly, gazing pitifully at my mother as if attempting to find some sympathy and help in another woman. I remember how earnestly my mother pleaded with my father to forget the documents he had signed, to refrain from any legal action. Father, accustomed to successful transactions on a large scale, could not understand the retailer's difficulties and was adamant. He declared that, although he was sorry about his client's bad luck and would help him in different ways, there was nothing he could do but carry out the legal proceedings. He explained that he could not think of breaking the long-established regulations of his firm. All he had to offer his wife in consolation was the thought that some of his other clients were in an even worse position. I recalled mother's helpless sympathy as Silveira's wife tearfully took her leave, and how father, indifferent to the suffering before him, scolded her severely and forbade her to interfere in business matters in the future. Thus, there was nothing left for the poor family but to face utter financial ruin. I could still see the Silveira's piano being carried away to satisfy the implacable creditor's claims. Humbled and penniless, Silveira moved with his wife and children to a small town, where they had probably led a life of hard work and poverty. I never again heard mention of the family. I was anxious to apologize, but did not know what to say. I had, at that time, encouraged father in his merciless attitude towards the Silveira and had considered mother too sentimental in her views. Being still very young, I was dominated by feelings of selfishness and vanity. Impervious to the needs and suffering of others, I was unyielding in my attitude in spite of my mother's wise exhortations. These memories flashed throughout my mind with incredible speed. In one short moment I had crossed the shadows of the past. I could hardly disguise my embarrassment. Silveira smiled, and called me back into reality. "Have you already visited the old man?" The question, so filled with spontaneous caring, only increased my confusion. I answered that, although anxious to do so, I had not yet had the chance. Silveira sensed my constraint and prepared to leave. He patted me affectionately on the back and went on his way. Disconcerted, I went to Narcisa and told her of our unexpected meeting and the circumstances of our parting on Earth. I anxiously awaited her advice. After listening carefully, she replied, "Don't be surprised at meeting old acquaintances here. Some time ago I found myself in a similar situation. I have already had the satisfaction of meeting most of the people here whom I had offended on Earth. I realize now that it's a great blessing granted us by the Lord, so that we may have new opportunities to take up friendships which have been interrupted, repairing the broken spirit links between us. Did you avail yourself of the chance offered you?" "What do you mean?" I asked. "Did you ask Silveira to forgive you? Remember, it's satisfying to be able to recognize our own faults. You have, by now, acquired enough understanding to be your own judge. You have acknowledged yourself as the offender. Don't miss the opportunity to gain a friend. Go to Silveira, my dear, and speak to him frankly. He is a busy person, and you may not get another chance soon." As I hesitated, she added, "Don't be afraid. Whenever we follow our head and heart in the practice of good, Jesus grants us the help necessary to succeed. The accomplishment of worthy actions, whatever they may be, constitutes a privilege to the soul. Keep the Master's gospel in mind and go seek the treasure of reconciliation." I no longer hesitated, but ran after Silveira, opening my heart to him and begging him to forgive both me and my father for our past errors. "You see," I explained earnestly, "we were both blind to everything but self-interest. Whenever money and vanity go together, few avoid taking the wrong path." Silveira, greatly touched, cut me short. "Listen, André, is anybody exempt from fault? Do you imagine that I led a blameless life? Besides, your father was a real teacher to me. My children and I are indebted to him for his valuable lessons in individual effort. Would we have made any spiritual progress, were it not for this firm defense of his rights? Over here, we renew all our old concepts of life and realize that our supposed enemies are really our benefactors. Don't brood over these sad memories. Let's look ahead to infinite life and work with the Lord." Noticing my moist eyes, he patted me on the back in a fatherly way, and added, "Don't waste your time over this. I hope I'll soon have the pleasure of accompanying you in visiting your father." I shook his hand in silence, feeling a new joy in my soul. It seemed that a dark little corner of my heart had been suddenly flooded with a divine light. Forever. Chapter 36, The Dream. Work went on without interruption. Many sick patients needed urgent care, and other perturbed entities required devoted attention. By evening I had mastered the technique of magnetic passes, which I applied to many of the patients. Tobias returned to the chambers in the morning, and more through generosity than any merit of mine, he encouraged me through his words of praise. "Well done, André," he exclaimed. "I'm going to mention you specifically to Minister Genesius, so you may receive your hour bonuses in double for your first efforts." As I was about to express my thanks, I was surprised to see Laura and Lizia's coming towards us. After affectionate greetings, Laura said to me with a smile, "We simply had to come to tell you personally how happy we all are. I followed you in spirit the entire night, and your first steps on the road of brotherly cooperation are a great joy to our family. I had the pleasure of giving the good news to Minister Clarence, who sends you his best wishes." We talked for a while, and they asked to hear my impressions. I was happy to oblige. Although Laura and Lizzie's invited me to return home with them to rest, Tobias had offered me a room in the chambers, where I could retire without delay. I felt an urgent need to sleep. Unbeknownst to me, the greatest joy of the day was still to come.